Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show. The term Zero Point is a phrase taken from H.P. Blavatsky, the grandmother of Western occultism. It's from a book called The Secret Doctrine. And within The Secret Doctrine, the idea is that any living being or universe or cosmos originates from a point source. And there's a first point of differentiation, and then something grows within without from a zero point, and it grows into a cosmos. And eventually, over time, that cosmos withdraws or collapses back into the zero point center. So the cosmoses originate out of zero points and dissolve back into zero point centers at the beginning and end of time. So in The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky describes the universe in this way and says there's an infinite number of universes that emerge out of the parent space, and they emerge within without from zero points and resolve back into zero point sources. Blavatsky also suggests that human beings, in a way, have a zero point center. She says, zero points are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. So this suggests that human beings have zero point centers. And I'm trying to explain through these programs and my work the idea that there is a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And in a way, in the heart, in the higher dimensional physics of the heart, we have to understand the vacated space and the idea of light, because consciousness in the human being is like light. So I'm saying that the origins of consciousness in the human being emerges within without from a zero point center, and that consciousness is like light. That with this light from the heart is distributed through the body, through the subtle anatomy, through the seven chakras and the three channels that link them, as well as through the physical body, through the blood and the circulation of blood in the body. So I am trying to explain the science of the soul, and that each human being has what is essentially a God spark within the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. A human being is ensouled through the heart. It is through the heart that the spiritual intelligences on higher planes of existence, their influence and intelligence is channeled down into a living human being. So in a way, I say the essential human being originates, exists in higher dimensional space. These monads, in a sense, exist in higher dimensional space, and they're embodied in a succession of different bodies. And so we are these beings that can live in a multidimensional universe, where there are physical planes and astral planes and mental planes, and then higher dimensional planes in the spiritual worlds. So through my studies, through my life, trying to understand human consciousness and realizing that all of Western science assumed consciousness is produced by the brain in the head, whereas all the mystical and esoteric teachings say that consciousness originates out of the heart. I is within the heart. One yogi defines yoga as involving the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. Yourself is within the heart. But people confuse themselves with the self in the mind, in the head, in the personality, in the conditioning. So people do not know themselves in the mystical sense, which involves the awakening of the human heart. And that awakening of the human heart involves this next state of human evolution, attaining the fourth level on the seven levels of human evolution. Most people are mainly physical, emotional, or mental types. But if you're transformed, you attain to the fourth level, and that involves the awakening of the human heart. It is within the heart that the human being actually has an I, meaning like the letter I, capital I. See, scientists don't think a human being has an I. They think you have a sense of self produced by parts of the cortex in the brain, but they don't think you really have an I. Whereas I'm saying we have an eye, and to understand what that eye is, we have to understand the mysteries of the human heart and the higher dimensional physics of the heart. We're not at all what we seem to be. And the teachings of the science of the soul have been there through human history, in yogic teachings, in Kabbalistic teachings, the secret doctrine, and elsewhere. But we've not really, modern times has failed to really understand the significance of these teachings and to try to understand this perspective on the mysteries of human consciousness. So the zero point shows, focuses on trying to understand the mysteries of the human heart and the idea that human beings have zero point centers or God sparks within the higher dimensional physics of the heart. Okay, I think Herta Bita, that will be our guest, so I'll hold on a moment to introduce him. So my main interest in life through the last 30 years is the mysteries of consciousness and the heart and mystical teachings and creation physics and things such as that. And then 2.5 years ago, I watched the movie Loose Change, which exposed the 9/11 fraud. And from there, kind of awoken more and more to the horrendous things being done in our society and happening now in the world. I really believe we're in a critical period in the life of humankind, and the forces of darkness are moving ahead most rapidly with their different agendas and to try to bring about a new world order. I call that the New World Psychiatric Disorder, which is more appropriate for it, because really these people are really quite severely disturbed, lower types on the evolutionary ladder of what humans can attain. In a way, they've held back the human race for so long through all their devious schemes and such. And now the knowledge of this new world order is exploding around the world. There are more and more shows exposing the frauds of 9/11 and the fraud of the London bombings and all these devious things being done. And we're learning more and more how the media has lied to us about so many things. We're waking up to realize we have a real beast upon us in what's in modern times. This week we were given heavy doses of chemtrails here. It's funny to look up in the sky and you see all these people are just spraying away, you know, spraying all these metal particles and aluminum things and desecrated blood particles and all these things. These people are insane, and there they are. Hardly anybody notices. You're being sprayed, People can't imagine anything so devious as the things being done to us by the New World Psychiatric Disorder. They really have no idea. J. Edgar Hoover, former head of the FBI, he once stated, "The individual is handicapped by coming face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous he cannot believe it exists." And this is the trouble for most people. We've been deceived by so many things for so long that we're going soon to have a rude awakening. We find the elites at this time, they're looting the wealth of nations, huge, huge payouts to all the banking and corporate elite who have committed all the bank fraud and collapse the markets and such. And the people bail them out. People don't even know in Canada we had a $75 billion bailout. One-tenth approximately of the American bailout. I guess they figured it proportionately because we're one-tenth the population of Canada has 30 million compared to U.S. 300. But in Canada, it wasn't even debated in Parliament or the House. It just passed by. Part of it, the first $25 billion to the banks, came up 2 days before the elections, and it wasn't even mentioned in the media. There was just one line on it somewhere. And then at a later point, they gave another $50 billion bailout to the banking institutions. This is from an article by Michelle Chalodowski from globalresearch.ca. So in Canada, we had a $75 billion bailout to the bankers, and nobody even knew. They did it much more easily in Canada. We're more taken. So anyway, so we're in a very serious situation. And so in the radio show through Zero Point, at times we deal with the mystical side of consciousness and occult teachings and such. But at other times, we're trying to face this spiritual war that we're engaged in this time on this planet, as we're all being threatened by the New World Psychiatric Disorder. We just have to tend the tide and take back our countries from these people. People have to wake up and begin to realize that this is serious and it's upon us. Okay, so I introduce my co-host, James Moffat from Toronto. Jim, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Okay. I heard some fascinating shows. Goodness, the more and more you learn, the worse and worse it gets. all the terrible things happening in the world and being done, and threat of more war and bailouts of the impoverishment of the population. I see this recession and economic collapse as all orchestrated by the elites to try to move ahead their New World disorder, psychiatric disordered system. But anyway, so we have a very interesting guest today, and I first heard this guest about 2 weeks ago on Alex Jones, and he had a shocking story, and this is part of Canada's history of genocide committed against Native Indians in Canada. And my guest is Kevin Annett, and we'll have him tell his story today, going from being a priest to uncovering all evidences about these terrible things that had been done out in the West Coast of Canada and among the schools run by the church and the government. And then I think that for the last 15 years, he's made an excellent movie on this, which you can view at his website. And his website is at, goodness, Kevin, you're there? Can you help me out?
Hi. Yes, I'm here. It's www.hiddenfromhistory.org.
Hidden from history, okay, .org. And you can watch his movie there, and he's going to be doing a tour through Canada and elsewhere in the months to come. So we'll have Kevin on for a good time today and hear his story, and we'll get him to tell us about his tour. And this is just another piece of this. This is part of Canada's shame. You know, as a nation, it's like we have these ghosts in our cupboards, these things, these terrible injustices which have never been addressed and never been faced. And it's like we in our society, we can't move ahead anymore because we've got such a monster in the room. And this is one of the worst chapters of Canadian history, which Kevin will share with us today. Thank you, Kevin, for agreeing to be on just such short notice. I only called you an hour ago.
Oh, that's fine. I appreciate the chance. Thanks, Chris, for having me.
Okay.
Chris, before we go ahead, could Kevin just, I'm sorry, I didn't get the, was it hiddenfromhistory.org or .com?
.org.
.org, thank you.
Thanks. Well, you know, probably the simplest way is if people go to that site, you can see our film Unrepentant on there, and it kind of tells the whole story. But for me, it has a lot of relevance this week because on Tuesday, the government and the local tribal council announced they're going to tear down the old remains of the United Church Residential School in Port Alberni. And that's a proven crime site. We already know from eyewitnesses that children were buried, you know, at that site. But they're going to just go in and tear the whole thing down. And I think it's another recent attempt by the government and the church is simply to get rid of the evidence, which is, you know, the remains of thousands of children who died in these places.
Yeah, it's terrible because it shows the kind of interwoven complicity of the churches, the RCMP. I mean, and you realize, like, this kind of evil influence has kind of penetrated these levels of our judiciary and police forces. It's really quite outrageous.
It's well, like it's always been a joint operation between the government and the churches. The RCMP were deputized to operate really as a security police for the residential schools, you know. And that's the trouble in Canada, that it's such a coordinated operation. We're really indicting the whole system with this. And so when you find the evidence, as we've established for years now, we have the evidence that genocide was deliberately committed. The question is always, where do you go with this information? We've been trying to recently get an international inquiry started, have groups come in to look at the evidence and that. But the problem is that, you know, the people doing this on the ground don't have a lot of resources, and you're up against these established government and churches, so it's really a constant uphill battle.
Yeah.
Chris, I just can I ask just ask maybe Kevin to most of our American listeners and anybody else overseas wouldn't really understand. Maybe Kevin could just explain what the residential school system was in Canada before we go forward.
Yeah, well, what they were as far back as the early 1800s, they were what they called Indian boarding schools, where missionaries would take native kids and simply brainwash them, make them forget their own language and culture as part of the way of dislocating them and getting off their land. So these boarding schools were always tied in very closely with the land grab and the attempt to force native people into extermination, really. But what happened in the late 1800s is that the government stepped in and set up a national structure in conjunction with all the main churches, Protestant and Catholic churches. And these were government-supported, but primarily church-run Indian residential schools. And they started in a big way around the 1890s, and they carried on for 100 years. The last one didn't close until 1996. We found over the last number of years that the government themselves acknowledged now that the average death rate in these schools was around 50%, so half the children never came back. And that was because of a practice of deliberately exposing kids to disease like tuberculosis and then over-treating them. That kind of massive germ warfare really to depopulate whole areas of the country, especially in the West, where a lot of the schools were situated. So it was really just part and parcel, kind of like the next stage in the plan of genocide that really wiped out about 95% of the native people in this part of the continent.
Wow. In your movie, at one point, do you estimate or guesstimate like 50,000, genocide of 50,000? Is that what you...
That's probably a conservative number because that's half the number of children who were in the school according to the government records, but we know that when the government says 125,000 kids were taken into these schools, they're not counting the fact that the RCMP would often grab all the children in the village, not just the kids 7 years and older, which the legislation stated that they could take those kids. They would take all the children. So the numbers are much higher than are officially described. So we're talking over 250,000 children probably went through these schools.
Wow.
You figure half of that, it's well over 50,000.
Yeah, over 100,000.
Over a century. And, of course, people often, when they see that number, they say, well, that's huge. How could that happen? Don't forget that over a century, for 50,000 kids to die in over 100 schools, all you need is to have 5 kids dying every year in every school. And we know that there were a lot more than 5 kids dying in a year. There's a lot of the people I work with in Vancouver, urban Aboriginal people, a lot of them are survivors of schools, and they have a lot of stories of, like, seeing children being buried, on the grounds of Catholic and United Church schools, seeing the graves and everything. So we know it's a very high number, and the next step in all this is to try to find these graves and do the forensic evidence, in examination to determine cause of death and all of that.
I guess you've had most personal experience, in Port Alberni.
Yeah.
Is it so? Do you have any idea of how many thousands might have been murdered there or disappeared from there? Or?
Well, Well, Port Alberni was one of the larger schools here on the coast. It was run by the United Church for over 50 years. And there were, on average, 300 to 400 kids in the school. So, I mean, you just do a simple calculation. If you have half those kids dying, and then if they're there for a 5 to 7 year period, you can just through mathematics work out that this is not only hundreds, it's probably in the thousands in this area of the province alone. So, you know, you multiply that by over 100 schools across the country, and you have a huge number of kids that simply vanish.
Kevin, it's my understanding, I'm not really, I don't really know that much about this, but it's my understanding that recently there was a settlement of a massive class action suit involving the residential school system in which natives and peoples in Canada were awarded, I think, something in the order of $3 billion. Do you know, were these issues ever raised in the context of the hearings that were conducted into this?
No, they made a point of deliberately not raising the issue of children dying. As a matter of fact, you know, this whole settlement is restricted to physical and sexual abuse.
Right.
And that $3.9 billion, actually most of it went into bureaucracy and the native chiefs who helped administer the money. Very little of it actually reached the people on the ground, the survivors. I know that because the people I work with, none of them have been able to access any of that compensation money. And another thing, too, is that when you accept this measly $10,000 that the government is offering survivors, you have to sign an indemnification agreement whereby the churches are let off the hook. To get the money, you agree never to sue the churches for anything, which is, you know, that's never required in any kind of legal settlement. Otherwise, you don't waive the right to sue the people who, you know, raped and tortured and murdered your friends. I mean, that's all a way to get the churches so that they don't have to face any kind of prosecution for these things. So, you know, behind the guise of all this talk of healing and reconciliation, it's just another cover-up and another way to protect the perpetrators, because in many cases those perpetrators are government and church officials who are still alive today.
You were kind of driven out of your work there as a minister. Do you consider yourself a Christian still?
Well, not in the sense of identifying with these churches or their tradition. I mean, I think that you can be a Christian or a believer in the teachings of Jesus without being connected to organized religion at all. And I think, in fact, organized religion is a big enemy of Christ and his teachings. I learned that the hard way, you know, through kind of my experience at the hands of these churches. But I think the bigger question is, well, they claim, you know, the churches claim to be doing one thing. In fact, if they're clearly responsible for the deaths of thousands of children, and they're still doing nothing to even do something as basic as returning the bodies of these kids, you know, why aren't they helping giving a proper burial to these children who died at their hands? Why aren't they being compelled to do so by the government and the police? You know, it's like amazing what they can get away with because they're these protected religious institutions. So, I mean, that's something that every Canadian has to look at. Like, how can we stand by and let them not only get away with murder, but now basically just allow their crime to be covered up and never be held accountable for it?
Yeah, to live with such hypocrisy. I mean, it's total hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I think all Catholics, you know, you have the confessional. It's like, wow, these people, you know, they can't deal at all with their history, and they really don't care at all for the people. It's just their own wealth, accumulated wealth, and to hide their crimes.
Yeah.
It's like they have no caring for truth or love or beauty or any of this. It's completely fraudulent. You know, that's kind of what's happened to the established churches, you know.
Very much, and I, you know, we find that all the time. Often our network will hold vigils and protests outside the churches, you know, and the response we get, especially from Catholics, is unbelievable. I mean, there's such hatred and hostility and denial going on. Even when we have eyewitnesses who were there, the people walking by, you know, they shove us, they call us names. I mean, it's incredible. I think we're clearly hitting a nerve just by standing there with the survivors of this crime. You know, they're involved really in a major Holocaust denial,
yeah.
which which
a Holocaust denial. That's a good term, appropriate term.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I just, you know, you wake up to the nightmare of the New World psychiatric disorder, and like the churches, like how could they have betrayed Christian teaching as they have? You know, it's just so unimaginable. It's disheartening. How our God, everybody's betrayed us. You know, the RCMP betray us. You know, they don't catch the criminals anymore.
Yeah.
They protect them. You know.
Well, it's interesting because even in the Bible, Jesus predicted that kind of religious hypocrisy. He said that many will come in His name, but don't believe them. He said, by their fruits you will know them.
Yeah.
You know, by the results of their actions, you'll know their nature. Well, that's something. You know, Canadians can look at these churches and say, okay, well, they were responsible for the death of these kids. They're still denying justice to the survivors. They won't even return the bodies of the children who died. Yet they claim to be Christian. They claim to be followers of Christ. Well, clearly they're not. But there's this kind of mind fog that exists around everybody when it comes to these churches. And our big job is breaking through that fog and saying, well, look, they're not who they claim to be. They don't even shouldn't have the right to exist under Canadian law. You know, we've called again for their charitable tax status to be revoked. And time and again we tell people, well, just stop going there. Stop giving them money because you're maintaining that lie and that crime by you know, being part of them.
Yeah, and I mean, the Catholic Church has been the biggest pedophile organization in the modern history of the human race. I mean, it has. I mean, it's not... I mean, across America, there are tens of thousands of cases of priests being charged with pedophilia. And I mean, our current Pope, Ratzinger, he's a guy who got to cover up all the sexual crimes of the Catholic Church. I think he was in that position for 7 years, and now he's Pope. And
yep.
You know, and he covers up 9/11 and the involvement of the Catholic Church in 9/11 with the Zionists. You know, these are criminal organizations.
Currently rehabilitating a Holocaust denier, too.
Yeah. Well, Ratzinger actually wrote the document that the Vatican adopted. So this is coming from the highest office of the Vatican. A document back in the 60s that was written and said that it was a policy that any bishop or priest who discovered sexual abuse going on had to suppress that knowledge of it.
Wow.
And had to force the victim to take a vow of silence. So in other words, and if they didn't do that, they'd face excommunication. So they're telling every priest in the Catholic Church around the world and every bishop that unless they broke the law and suppressed evidence of crime, they'd be excommunicated.
Wow.
And that's coming from the Pope's office, right?
When was that document was?
That document was published in 1962. It's under the hand of, well, the department that Ratzinger was associated with, which is really kind of the modern-day office of the Inquisition. It's got a different name, but and I've got it. Actually, I was going to post it on my website. I've talked about it on my radio program, but I can, if you give me your email, I can send you the link to that.
Yeah, I'd really be interested in that. That's incredible.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's called a criminal conspiracy, actually.
Completely, and you know what's amazing is they can do that and they get away with it, and nobody holds them accountable to the fact that they're telling. Still to this day, they're saying you have to break the law and protect pedophiles or you'll face excommunication.
And now he's the Pope.
Yep.
Wow.
I mean, this pedophilia and there's been so many psychopaths and perverts within the Catholic Church. And then I think that's how in ways they also infiltrate the RCMP and the judiciary is that, I mean, these native children were used by these men as pedophiles and they were given, made available to other people, were they not, likely?
Yeah, I'll talk to people who, you know, like older women or men who remember when they were kids being lined up outside the school like it was a slave auction. And these white guys, you know, church and government people or Mounties would show up and pick them out of the line and take them off and then never see these kids again. They talked about that thing happening regularly, and in fact, those pedophile networks are still operating. There's a place called the Vancouver Club, a big, it's probably the prestigious kind of establishment club in downtown Vancouver on West Hastings Street, And it, time and again, people have described seeing young Native boys and girls being taken in there by stretch limousine into the back door off some of the Squamish reserves in Vancouver. So these pedophile networks continue to operate. And, you know, of course, why wouldn't they when they have that kind of strong government and church protection, police protection?
Yeah. Wow. And then through the media, because the media completely lies to everybody about everything. The media continually hides the kind of criminal activities of our government.
Well, CanWest, you know, owns a big chunk of the newspapers in Canada. And they are overtly hostile to any discussion of you know, Native issues or these residential school murders.
Yeah.
So that's the importance of this program and other alternative media. I mean, this is the only way we get the word out.
Yeah. So, Kevin, how did you get interested in that, or how did you begin to study this and become aware of this, the level of crime, which is basically unreported?
Well, I really learned it on the ground as a minister in Port Alberni. I worked before Port Alberni. I went there in 1992, but before that, in the 80s, I was working as a street minister as I was preparing for ordination, and I worked out at First United Church on East Hastings, and I began to encounter a lot of this stuff there. But it was only in Port Alberni when I began to open my pulpit to survivors that I began to hear these stories. And one of the first things that made me realize the, you know, genocidal effect this stuff was still having was all the funerals I was doing. I would regularly get called out to the local Indian reserves around Port Alberni to do funerals of young teenage kids, children who died. I mean, it was constant. And I realized, well, this is coming from somewhere. You know, you don't have a death rate 20 times the national average. Unless it's coming from a history. And yet all the whites are going around pretending, oh, no, it's just because they drink a lot or something, right? They're totally unwilling to look at what had caused this historically, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you think of what happened, I read somewhere that it was kind of a policy that in a war, if 10% of an opposing force is killed off, it completely traumatizes them. Now imagine having 50% of your people killed off. What that does to people is it permanently traumatizes them and makes them incapable of functioning.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the purpose. If you want to get somebody's land and resources, that's exactly what you have to do to them. And, you know, it happens in Guatemala. It happens all over the world where corporations want to go in and get the land and resources. You do that to the native population. Well, Canada's no different. That's what's happened here, and it's why it's continued.
Yeah, you destroy a people's way of living, and you destroy a people. I mean, it's an ecological thing in a sense, and then it's has a spiritual effect. And as you say, it people demonstrate all the qualities that anybody who's abused demonstrates: apathy and inability to help themselves, and addiction, and all the problems that go with it that flow from that. Directly attributable to the original offense against them, which is to steal their way of life.
Yep, exactly.
I guess you're not involved in any current legal proceedings at any level. What would need to be done before that would happen, that somehow the RCMP would be forced to conduct a criminal investigation? But I guess that goes to someone in the government who oversees justice, does it?
Since 1996, so that's over 12 years now, I've been trying through the courts, through, you know, lobbying government, all that, to get some kind of response, and it's a complete shutout, as would be expected, because a lot of these perpetrators are still alive.
Yeah.
And the institutions are liable under the Nuremberg laws for committing crimes against humanity. So naturally they're going to shut it down and try to spin the whole issue as, which is what they've done quite successfully in Canada, as, yes, some terrible things happened. Now here's some money and an apology. You know, the Prime Minister gets up in Parliament last June and makes this so-called apology. And they even refer to graves of children, and yet there's no accountability. Well, why, if they're concerned about children dying, why don't they then take the next step and put on trial the people responsible? But there's none of that. It's kind of like absolving themselves of any responsibility for these crimes. So what we came to realize a few years ago, working with some of the local indigenous elders, not the band council chiefs who are like government employees, really, but the hereditary chiefs, there's talk now about setting up their own courts of justice to try perpetrators in, you know. Part of their declaration of sovereignty is they want to set up their own Aboriginal courts and bring these men and women responsible for these crimes in and try them. So instead of relying on the Canadian court system, which is not going to in any way hold itself accountable or the government responsible for these things, people need to start doing it themselves, and I think that that's the way that this thing is really going to be brought out completely.
You have, is that the Republic of Kanata? Is that related to that group?
Yeah, that's right. That because when you're talking about taking back the land and setting up your own courts, you're really saying, well, we're declaring independence from the Crown and the churches. When the Crown owns all the land in Canada and it's monopolizes things like that, we're still living under a colonial system, and the only way to set that right is to simply get rid of those institutions that caused the genocide. So I think it's the logical conclusion of all this is to realize, well, we need an actual republic of federated nations, recognizing the sovereignty of all the different nations and bringing all of us together into kind of a republic where we control our own destiny and we're not subject to the so-called Crown, which was really the cause of these crimes. I mean, if you trace the origin of where this genocide originated, it goes to London, England, you know, to Buckingham Palace, and to the Vatican. And those are the two institutions that have to ultimately be held accountable for these crimes. But you can't do that if you're part of the system. You know, there's a real practical problem here. All of the lawyers and judges in Canada and all the members of Parliament, they all take an oath of loyalty to the Crown.
Yeah.
Well, how can you then put the Crown on trial? You can't, using the institutions that are here.
Well, I mean, I think if you could take those institutions back, you might. But
yeah.
I mean, at least in the existing situation, you couldn't.
Right, and I mean,
it's like 9/11 events. You know, like it amazes me. Why the RCMP? I mean, everybody knows 9/11 was an inside job. Now it's known around the world. The majority of people know it, but the RCMP, you know, they don't really do anything to capture any of the terrorists. Like the whole thing is a fraud. You know.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing with. It's very analogous to the residential school thing. They know who the perpetrators are. We publish their names. These people not one person has ever been brought to trial in Canada for the death of a child in a residential school. Now, why is that?
Yeah. Yeah, and then the protection afforded the church, they buy them out through,
yep.
So, because really the church, I mean, should be open to, you know, massive, massive civil suits. I mean, all the wealth of the Catholic Church.
Oh, yeah.
Should be taken from them and these people imprisoned, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What about petitioning or trying to bring something before the United Nations or the International Criminal Court?
Well, the problem with that is that the legislation set up around the ICC is very restrictive. Under the International Criminal Court mandate, you can't bring a case for a crime that happens before 1998.
Oh.
So that automatically excludes the residential school completely.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. I didn't realize that their mandate was that restricted, that was that recent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so horrifying, too, because then you look at the United Nations, and then it's just another totally corrupted institution, like, you know, the United Nations. I mean, they've hidden the crimes of 9/11. They've hidden all the agenda of the New World Order and all the devious things done through UN programs. I mean, it's like there's nowhere to turn. It's like we live in an insane society, unfortunately. You know, and so many of these institutions are all tied into the Rockefeller and World Churches. It's like the whole system it has become corrupted.
Well, absolutely. Although, you know, part of this is, you know, when... A lot of this has to do with losing our illusions. I mean, you know, we're raised to think of these institutions as something they're not actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you on the basis of how they act in practice, that's how you judge them. And, I mean, there's no indication the government and the church is ever going to hold themselves accountable for this. And as long as people keep looking to them for some kind of resolution, I mean, for one thing, that's designed to drag this thing out so long that a lot of the survivors and the eyewitnesses are going to die off. We know that residential school survivors are dying at a rate of 10 or more a day across Canada. Right. Another few years of this, and there's not going to be anyone left to actually be able to, you know, name the names here. And that's the purpose of a lot of this stuff. So that's why it's really important wherever people are to contact these survivors and take down their story and get the evidence recorded. I mean, that's a lot of what I do to try to do that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially been a lot of the Canadian government's strategy over land claims is, over the last 100 years, is that in places where, especially in places where numbers are dwindling, just let them die out. You know, we'll tie this up in the court forever, and these guys will never get a settlement, you know. And then if, when the natives rightly respond to it by, you know, blockading a road or occupying a site, you know, everybody gets up in arms and says, well, what about the rule of law? That's the one that kills me, is that, you know, that whenever somebody protests and brings this to people's attention, the injustice that's been done to the natives, they say, well, you know, these guys don't want, they don't want to obey the rule of law. And I think, you got to be kidding, rule of law. You know, these people have been, exploited and subjugated for 250 years, and people are preaching to them about the rule of law. It's completely ludicrous. And they've been victims of the law.
And
exactly.
Still are around the country. Like, there's this case now in Ontario where the government wants the uranium from sites in Ontario. And even by Canadian law, it's illegal for uranium to be sold for weapons. But the weapon industry is so huge, and now they kind of force the Indians off the land. And I think the chiefs of the tribe were put in jail for protesting when they started.
Right.
And they create, like, depleted uranium clouds through eastern Ontario here. Like, again, it's just totally criminal, you know?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the uranium, because one of the things that is a real problem, especially in Saskatchewan, is uranium poisoning on Indian land. And there's this company, Camco, which is actually the world's largest uranium producer. They provide depleted uranium to the U.S. military. Well, they, kind of an interesting story about that. The guy, there was a member of parliament called Gary Morasty, and he stood up and asked some questions about the children who died in the residential schools back in 2007. And he asked for them to have their, you know, the remains repatriated, right, for proper burial. That's the thing that started a lot of this recent, you know, government apology and everything, was the fact that this Native member of parliament stood up and did that. Well, a couple of months later, he's offered a job by Camco, this uranium company, as their PR guy, and now he's working for them. He stepped down. He was no longer a member of parliament. So basically, the uranium industry went in and bought this guy to silence him.
Yeah.
Because they know that they don't want, like, say, a lot of these residential schools are on Native land, which is still coveted by these companies and the government. So they don't want people poking around, looking into the grave sites, and stopping, you know, the theft of this land. And that's what the liability of the government getting into this issue too much is, that might happen. So they do everything possible to. You know, this isn't just an issue of the past. They very much want this whole discussion stopped about the grave sites and bringing the remains home of the children. So that's an example of how they do that.
I've heard that, like, I guess in the eastern states, when the Europeans wanted to get rid of the natives, they gave them blankets infected or used by people who had died in Europe of the plague in Europe. And they gave blankets to the American Indians and intentionally spread diseases through their communities in that way. Do you know anything about that, Kevin? How many people?
Well, we talk about that in our movie. In Canada, it happened in Nova Scotia. Well, all over, really. The whole regime in the residential schools involved deliberately exposing kids to tuberculosis and then letting them die from it. That happened over decades. That's why the death rate was so high, for one thing. But in eastern Canada, long before that, there was a diary kept by General Amherst, Jeffrey Amherst, in Nova Scotia. And he described taking smallpox blankets and distributing it among the Mi'kmaq Indians in order to kill them off. So, I mean, it's documented by the people's own diaries that was happening in Canada as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I see modern day vaccinations as the blankets, white man's blankets to the Indians. I'm sure they promote a lot of vaccination programs through the native groups.
They do still. I had a friend who was a public health worker out among the Stolo Band, which is east of Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
and she was trying to get the band council to simply say to the mothers who had kids that there was alternatives to vaccinations. And she was fired by the Medical Services Branch of Health Canada right away when she even was talking about alternatives to vaccinations, because she found that they were forcing these vaccines on children and including flu vaccines on elders who would then die as a result of it.
Yeah.
But they kept doing it. You know, so it's kind of like when you have public health nurses pushing flu vaccines on people who are living on the street. Well, people who are sick and undernourished, the last thing you do is introduce that into their system because they're more susceptible to die from it. So all of that indicates that, yeah, it's a way to kill people off. It's a way to continue.
I mean, there's more and more evidences. I don't know if you know the new head of the Canadian Action Party is a PhD psychologist and medical doctor, and his specialty is vaccinations.
Right.
And he's saying all these vaccinations. He says it's not the flu in it, if it's a flu vaccine, but it's the buffers like the mercury, the
right.
formaldehyde, the
all
aluminum,
those.
And that these are causing that the particles are too large and they obstruct the capillaries and it causes mini strokes. So you got all these kids getting autism and learning disabilities
exactly.
and
yeah.
infertility, all these kinds of problems caused by the inoculation programs. It's a huge, huge problem. Not just for natives, but I mean, it seems that this time in human history, we have an elite who are trying not only to commit further genocide against the native community, but against the non-native community as well.
That's the thing. I mean, it's not restricted to native. They were just one of the more recent test subjects, if you like, but the general plan, I think, is world depopulation, and I think that there is a definite plan to get down to wipe out a lot of indigenous and other populations. You know, they've already acknowledged that the UN, the World Health Organization, has been putting sterilizing agents in a lot of their vaccines. I mean, that's
yeah.
being detected all over the world.
Yeah.
Well, Native people are third world, and it's happening here as well, because Native people have the highest birth rate of any ethnic group in Canada.
Yeah.
I have a question actually about your film. I'm looking at your website, and I'm just wondering how did the feature length documentary film, how did that come about that you were able to make this film?
Well, it was actually surprisingly easy because I had a lot of the evidence and testimonies. We got together with the director who lives right here on Vancouver Island. My partner Carol and I and Louis Lawless, who's the director, we got together in over a period of about 18 months.
Please tell me that that's not his real name.
Yeah, it is, Louis Lawless.
Oh, really?
I thought it was quite an appropriate name, actually.
Yeah, that must have been a sign, a divine
Definitely.
Sign that you were on the right track. That's
I think
great.
So. Yeah, we often joke about that.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
But, I mean, it was, Louis had the technology simply to take what we filmed on his computer and then edit it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing with the internet and the computer technology now. People can go out and make their own films, and that's something we need to do. Like, we only scratch the surface. There needs to be more of these documentaries done about, really, the effect today, the ongoing genocide and how it's playing out. But, we were really surprised when we started distributing the film kind of grassroots, how it's been taken up. I mean, you know, probably now by now over 100,000 hits on the Google sites.
Wow!
Wow!
That, you know, it's been shown and won several awards at documentary film festivals in America.
Wow! Excellent.
In Los Angeles and New York.
Well, what year was that it won those awards?
In 2007.
Were you down there and received the award?
No, I couldn't afford to go down. But it was, you know. All over the world, people are watching it. It's even been translated into French and German and Italian.
Wow, excellent.
And so, yeah, it's really catching on. I get emails all the time from all over the world of people who've seen it, you know, even off the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, I think, you know, I continually get invited out to Native communities to show it and to talk about it. And the amazing thing I find is that a lot of the younger Native men and women have never knew any of this stuff. Their parents, grandparents would never tell them about it because they're too terrified.
Yeah, and traumatized by it. I mean,
totally.
It's unspeakable. I mean, I think that's part of the... These people are so traumatized by what they experience that, you know,
yeah,
they turn to drugs and alcohol and living on the street and can't speak of it. You know?
Well, that's right, and knowledge is incredibly empowering. After they've seen the film, it's often the case that they will, you know, say, well, now I understand. Now we know why our families are screwed up. We don't have to blame each other anymore.
Yeah.
It's because of these laws in this regime that was in place. Now we should direct our anger at the people who really deserve it, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a very politicizing, a radicalizing thing when people can do that.
Yeah.
They don't have to be kind of oppressed anymore. They can take action. And sure enough, I mean, those tend to be the people who come out on our protests and have the courage to confront the police and the church people are these survivors, you know, who, I mean, don't have anything to lose, for one thing, but they're really angry about what's happened to them and their people. And, you know, all of this talk of compensation and money, that it just means nothing to them because it doesn't mean anything, really. It's just a way for the institutions to avoid being held accountable.
And then even then, the government, you know, they give so many billions, but, you know, they'll buy out who they own in within their own structures, and then what ends up get, you know, down to the person on the street or something, like next to nothing.
Yeah, very little. I don't see any of it trickling down to people on the street. Things are getting so much worse. And even when it does, you know, people who are severely addicted or on drugs or alcohol, you hand them $10,000 and what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
You know, people overdose and die, and again, that's not accidental. They want them to do that. They give them just enough to kill themselves with, basically.
I imagine it would be, in terms of that, that was going to be my question to you about showing this to natives and how they've reacted. I mean, imagine the people that have not spoken about this for 50 years and have witnessed all these atrocities and have been traumatized by this. It must be incredibly cathartic for them just to be able to have a discussion about this, to have this come out in the open. I mean, it must be amazing to people in these circumstances.
It's one of the things that I find most fulfilling in this work, and that when you see that happen, you know, people in their 80s who'd never even been able to mention it to the people they love the most, and then are able to talk about that in a public meeting and name the names and say, this happened to me.
Wow.
You know, it's just an amazing, indescribable kind of thing to be part of. And it's too bad that there's so much racism in Canada where a lot of white people don't know many Native people, you know, because they need us as allies. I mean, they're only 2% of the population. And we need, in the majority, you know, like Euro-Canadians have to say, this is about us. This isn't about Native people. This is something we caused, our churches and government. This is, if anything, an issue that we have to take on.
And this is even further with that,
yeah,
is that these people who do this are currently in power and in control, and
that's right,
this abuse is going on still.
Right.
I mean, BC, I guess, now has become, you know, center for kind of smut and pornography and pedophilia,
yeah,
and
exactly,
all these things that our police don't service. Like, the RCMP always catch a man, eh? Yeah, give me a break. Like, you know, it's like they brought dishonor on the RCMP.
Yep.
You know, the RCMP are totally dishonored in our age. You know, we had this 9/11 thing, and what did the RCMP did? Nothing. You know, all they ever do is like, cover up the crimes of their masters, whoever they are.
Well, especially since they were created specifically to destroy the Native populations in the West. That was the reason for setting up the RCMP. We should get rid of them as an institution, just like Indian Affairs. I mean, these are colonial institutions we've got to get rid of.
Yeah. Wow. Boy, our problems in society, Kevin, is there any hope?
Of course. I mean, I see it all the time, but, you know, you see hope on the ground. You see it in small ways from people who you work with, and it percolates upward. So it's important to stay down there with people because that's how we strengthen each other, keep each other going. I should probably mention that I'm coming through Ontario in the week of April 27th.
Yeah, well, I've got your schedule here, and
it said February. The problem was that there was a number of people who were going to fund it who couldn't come up with the money till April. So we basically had to put it off a couple of months. But it's actually going to give us more time to organize these different venues and that. So I just want, if anyone's listening, you can contact me at hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca, and we can talk about organizing some kind of, you know, event in your area.
Wow. Yeah, good. Do you have any materials you send out to native bands across the country, or emails?
We have DVD copies of the film and a lot of other material. Some of it you can download from our website. That's hiddenfromhistory.org. But I can also send it to anybody if you email me.
I'm just looking here at something, Kevin, that you appeared on As It Happens on May 28, 2007, and you can access it here on your website. How did that go? What was that conversation like?
Well, that was with, there was this government Indian called Bob Watts, and he was running the Truth and the Reconciliation Commission for a while. And he was defending it, you know, saying that even though it didn't have the power to actually issue subpoenas or really to do a criminal investigation, it was going to be a good thing. And I was really debating him and challenging him and saying, well, how can you have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission if it's set up by the very churches and government that ran these schools? You know, the TRC mandate, if when they hold these, this is something else I should mention, that when they hold these forums, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, if you're a survivor, you can't name the name of a perpetrator. You can't talk about wrongdoing that happened in the school unless it's been before the court already. Well, none of these issues of murder and that have ever gone to court.
Right.
So it's a way of saying to people, you know, it's a way of gagging people
legally,
and that's what the TRC is doing. It's under the guise of being, you know, seeking the truth. They're just gagging people, just like these court settlements have done.
So it's the truth, but not the whole truth.
Well, it's the truth that is going to be allowed by the government and the churches
right.
who run the
school. Yeah, it's a different lie.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, the way they cover out one lie is to tell new ones.
Yeah,
exactly.
I know he's not going to cite this, but also on Kevin's website for our listeners, that says that, quote, Kevin is more deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize than many who have received it in the past. That's Noam Chomsky, which is a rather... That's got to be encouraging to have someone say that, especially as prominent as Noam Chomsky.
It is. I mean, in fact, I spoke to Noam a couple of times. I met him once and gave him a copy of my book, and he would have been more helpful, except he's in his 80s now, and his wife is dying of cancer, so it's been hard for him to kind of, and plus he has hundreds of requests every week to go and speak. So, but he said to me that, you know, this whole thing of genocide is really at the heart of our struggle here in North America. And it should be focused on a lot more. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, has been keeping me going, that kind of support. And it's out there. It's just that people have to see the connections between what happened in the past and what's still going on now, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's why this is such an important piece of our history and of our past. And, and these people are still in power. Like, that's why it's like these, you know, 9/11, like, that was a terrorist act, and it was never dealt with, and that's left these people in power now, and they still are in Canada.
Yep.
You know, and the police aren't serving us. They, you know, somehow have become corrupted at the highest levels. And
I was rather alarmed the other day when I saw that Dick Cheney was all over the news talking about how there's going to be another terrorist attack. I'm thinking,
how does he know exactly?
Yeah, and he's putting it out there as if, you know, because he and Bush have gone away and aren't there to protect people anymore. I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, aren't you the guy that was behind this in the first place? Like, you know, at least on some level in terms of complicity.
And there was a move.
Planning of it, you know, like, it's just more deceit, you know. It's the usual, it's the shell game that they play in the media, you know. It's like the old misdirections. It's incredible.
Well, they were going to indict Cheney in Texas, and I think that fell through, but...
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see that happen.
Yeah.
Well, these guys, you never really see any of these guys, you know, in the dock where they belong. They generally end up getting Nobel Peace Prizes or awards from some organization, you know.
Well, it's like I say, we got to hold these people accountable ourselves. You can't rely on their own institutions to do that, you know.
I mean, there's a worldwide truth movement, I think, now that people like never before are waking up to the fact that, yes, we do. There is, as Hoover says, a conspiracy so monstrous that people can't believe it exists. People are waking up to this fact and identifying mm-hmm. who these people are and behind the scenes. And
Given that J. Edgar Hoover was part of a monstrous conspiracy, that's quite a frightening comment. I meant to comment on that earlier because, you know, he himself oversaw a vast conspiracy, you know, and that committed all sorts of criminal activities. And the fact that he's pointed to conspiracy beyond the conspiracy is rather disturbing. I just want to say again that this is, I'm just looking at this website. This is an excellent website. It's a fascinating and I really urge everybody to go to www.hiddenfromhistory.org. It's really nicely laid out, Kevin. Very nice.
Thank you. Yeah.
I know. Do you publish your book in kind of a Sirlock binding?
It's a ring binding, so that
ring
people
binding,
can photo.
Yeah.
I don't copyright any of my work, so people are free to photocopy the book, make copies of the film, because it's important this knowledge get out there, right?
Yeah.
So, the book and the film can be ordered from me, and I intend to bring copies when I come to Ontario.
Yeah, good. So, are you delaying when you head off? I noticed you were beginning Castlegar and Nelson. I know the area, a nice area.
It is, yeah. I'm going there, but I just didn't have the means to get east right now. And over the next couple of months, you know, people are going to raise the funds and that to do it. But we need more time to, you know, organize some of the, I'm supposed to meet some of the tribal elders out there as well, and they very much want to proceed with this independent investigation. We have support of indigenous groups in Mexico and Guatemala for an international investigation, right, like non-governmental inquiry and all of this. So that's one of the things we're trying to bring together now.
Yeah, it's an alternative to trying to reform our system. I mean, our system is so corrupted.
Yeah.
But if people were awakened to it, I still think it's possible we could take back our country.
Yep, we have to.
Yeah, we have to. We have to. I mean, they're spraying us with chemtrails. They're injecting our children. They're poisoning us. They're gonna take the food away now, you know?
Yep.
The food and jobs will be penniless, like Rothschild once says, you know, let me control the money and, you know, people will end up penniless on the street, you know?
Yep.
That's what they'll do. These people think of nothing of murdering hundreds of thousands or millions. I mean, there is this population reduction program. People can't awake to realize it. They can't believe it.
Well,
see, that's how I see it, so monstrous that people can't believe it's true. You can't believe it's true that there really is a group of psychopathic, satanic element that would perpetuate these crimes against the human race. It's being done now.
It's interesting you mentioned about the chemtrails over Ottawa, because we had the same thing in Vancouver this last week. I've got an asthma attack right now, and I know it's related to what happened. You saw the chemtrails all over Vancouver skies. So it's happening all at the same time, it seems.
Yeah, it's done across the country. I drove down to Toronto last week. I could see it all through southern Ontario.
Yeah.
I mean, it's being done around the world. I mean, we are being poisoned through the chemtrails.
Yeah.
You know, the neurotoxins, they can cause a chronic fatigue, Morgellons, skin diseases, eye irritations, different internal problems. We don't know all that, and they experiment. They put different ingredients in it, and to think from a native perspective, you know, you honor the elements, say, the air and the fire and water and earth, and what these people do, they have no respect for life. I mean, imagine that, poisoning people massively through spraying them from the air. I mean, isn't that monstrous?
Well, it's all part of that same thing that could murder innocent children. It's like a total disregard for life and its sanctity.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we have to fight, definitely.
Is there much is there a growing awareness within Native communities to waking up to the New World Order and all the criminal things being done by our government and that? I guess Natives have known this through history, so they don't need any more evidence.
I don't think they need to be told this.
No, exactly. It's not like they don't know this stuff. It's always a question of what can they do about it.
I think
there's more empowerment definitely among younger people who aren't as traumatized by the whole residential school syndrome.
So
they have prophecies about that, you know, in the seventh generation, the recovery of their culture. You hear that all over the different nations.
What generation would you say we're in?
Well, this is in, well, at least on the in the West, this is the seventh generation.
It is.
It's older in the East. But it's interesting because knowing some of the Mohawk people, they're a very interesting group to get to know, and I urge people to, if you know a Mohawk, to sit down and talk to them, because they have kept a lot of their culture and their great law, and it's the great law of peace, and it was it's what's allowed them to survive this genocide. So I think I can see their nations coming back. Maybe they're the only ones that are going to survive this Holocaust that's going to come, you know?
Yeah, they're likely better prepared a bit, like are used to surviving with less and in the countryside more and more self-sufficient in ways.
Well, they're more organized in large part. I mean, that's part of it, is that the Mohawks have always been pretty savvy and pretty strong in terms of their culture and their organization. It's a very strong group. And I don't know if a lot of people probably don't know this, but a lot of the American Constitution is taken from the Mohawk Nation. The fundamentals of their laws. Yeah, a lot of that's taken from the Mohawk Confederation, because they were a precursor of the 13 colonies, in the sense that you have the six nations and you have the Mohawk Confederation as the Confederation of Nations.
That's right. And I remember when I was down in New York, I was speaking to the Onondaga Six Nations. One of the components of the Confederacy, and the people there said that in the early 1900s, the American suffragettes, they were coming out to them to study their society, because they were a matrilineal system, and the clan mother would appoint the chiefs and could remove the chief. And they said they had to go there to study them because there was no other place they could go where women had some sense of, or had a position of power, right? So it's interesting how they do, you know, they kind of have so positively influenced us Europeans here in Turtle Island.
In the Native community, like, do you hear people talking of chemtrails much?
Among the Native people, no. No, I mean, there isn't that as much of that awareness of that, and that's one of the
Were you aware of the case of the Natives in Northern Ontario who took it all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada to have it stopped?
Really? I never knew that.
Yeah, apparently it got all the way to the Supreme Court, and in the end, the Supreme Court declared that, well, it wasn't, they weren't being sprayed by Canadians, because they used pilots from other countries to spray in Canada, and Canadian pilots to fly elsewhere, so it wasn't their domain.
Really? I never knew that. Was this the Northern Cree?
Yeah. And they took it to the Supreme Court.
Do you remember what year that was?
No, but not within the last five, I think.
So they said that it was, did they say who was flying the chemtrail jets?
I don't really know the details, and it's something I've wanted to research.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Is this a Quebec Cree or the Ontario?
No, Northern Ontario.
Northern Ontario Cree, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, interesting that Kevin mentioned the Guatemala, too, because there's been a systematic program of genocide against the natives in Guatemala over the last 75 years, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very, very bad, bad place in terms of, I mean, well, all of Central America is seeing this concerted effort to wipe out the native populations.
Well, you know, the thing about in Guatemala and the Mayan people, they're the ones who've been most supportive of what we're doing. I got a statement recently from six of their organizations where they support what we're doing and are going to be part of this inquiry, you know.
Wow.
Into genocide
wow.
in Canada. So it's they know from their own experience what it's like, right?
Yeah, that's really hard.
This has been done around the world. It's been done in Australia to the Aboriginals and New Zealand to the Maori. And I mean, around the world, these corporate elites, when they pillage countries and impoverish them.
Yep.
I mean, it's so disgraceful. So I guess you don't know now when you're heading off on your series. Oh, but you're going to be in Ottawa April 18th, I think you were saying.
Well, no, it'll be the week of April 27th.
The week of April 27th.
That week I've got set aside for Southern Ontario, including Ottawa.
Yeah.
So Ottawa, Toronto, that whole area.
So you'll put your schedule up on your site.
I will, and I can also. Well, I'll email that to you, Chris. And I'm sorry, I've got your other friend's name there.
Yeah,
Jim.
And I'm in Toronto actually, Kevin too.
Jim?
So you know, if you need a place to stay, you can definitely come and stay with
me. Thank you.
You know,
could I get your email?
Sure. It's J Moffett, MOFFATT.
Yep.
1181.
Yeah, 1181?
Yeah, that's after my name. jmoffett1181@yahoo.ca.
Great. I'll definitely write you.
Okay, great. And I know some people here, too, that will definitely be interested in attending and helping to promote your appearance.
Well, thank you.
That'd be great, yeah.
As a matter of fact, there's a group in Toronto called Friends and Relatives of the Disappeared, and they actually held protests inside churches last year. Some of them went right into the church and confronted the people.
Wow.
I'll send you all the clippings about that. But,
okay, great.
They're a good group. I'll send you their name.
Okay, great.
So another, at the moment, Kevin, I'm the chair of the Native and Aboriginal Affairs for the Canadian Action Party.
Mm-hmm.
And as I had mentioned to you earlier, I was interested in any recommendations you might have as to, you know, what would serve natives and Aboriginal people. I guess, like, first off, from our discussion, would we need a complete investigation and prosecution of the people who committed the genocide against the natives of British Columbia?
Well, and of Canada, because, of course, there's a national system. But, yeah, definitely we need that. And calling for that independent inquiry and urging people not to endorse or take part in this TRC, or the Government's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because it's really designed to not only gag people but to gather information which can then be used against people. And so, you know, for example, the grave sites, the last people you want to go out and examine these sites are the RCMP, because they were the ones who often would be burying the children. So it's that, you know, calling for that independent investigation that's so important right now.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So, and then there's this issue. I mean, in Canada, we've got such an issue. I don't think people had any idea we were so dominated by the Crown and by this kind of criminal elite class in our society. And so I guess another issue is like the sovereignty or independence of natives being able to assume a separate, like, Republic of Canada. I like that.
Well, yeah, it's almost like we have to talk at the big level and the small level at the same time, because you can't really undertake these things within the framework we have right now, because it's a colonial system.
Yeah.
Like, why do we have a governor general who has the power theoretically of removing the government? I mean, that's not responsible government. It's because you have systems like that in place that you can have this genocide happening. You know, why are the churches beyond the law? Why are they allowed to commit these crimes and then be absolved from any responsibility for them? So, I mean, it's all of that that needs to be kind of addressed by saying, well, the political system itself has to change so that the reforms and changes on the ground can happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, our whole government has become criminal. I mean, here we are, the government. I mean, just conceive this. The government of Canada has lied to the Canadian people about the causes of the war in Afghanistan and taking Canadian military over there to fight a war so that the corporate elite can have new military bases and run the drug trade and have their oil lines. And they've intentionally deceived the Canadian population about the what's underlying our involvement in Afghanistan. I mean, that's outrageous.
Completely. And so, I mean, in a way, it's not surprising when you look at all the other crimes they've committed. Why would they stop?
Is there much suspicion in the Native community about vaccination programs? That is a big issue for me. I'm very concerned about that.
Well, you know, when you say Native communities, I mean, there about two-thirds of Natives live off reserve in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And on reserve, it's very difficult. They're like little banana republics run by a few families, and very much, you know, people are in a kind of state of terror there. But off reserve, they don't have access to a lot of the funds, so a lot of them are in poverty and are struggling on their own.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to find groups that are coherent that are you're able to work with because they're so atomized in the Native culture. And so it's hard to, in a way, generalize about that, but...
I mean, the government, I would think, kind of infiltrates the Native groups and puts their own public health nurses in there, and the public health nurses are brainwashed into thinking the vaccines are good, and then they kind of give them out, and they don't really, you know, comprehend what's really underlying this.
Well, that's true, and you definitely, like in that case I gave you of my friend who was a public health nurse, she was shut down very quickly by Health Canada. And the chiefs just went along with it. So that's the trouble, you know, when you have that colonial system, and it's hard to fight it from within it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, our problems are just so huge. It's not like one or two corrupted individual. It's like a completely corrupted government, a completely immoral country it's become. Deception of the population, the spraying of the people, all these additives being put into food. Like Health Canada doesn't protect the health of Canadians anymore. They betray us at every possible turn.
Yeah.
They allow genetically GM foods into to be used, and then they don't require that they be marked, and then they cover up the evidences that they're causing cancers and so on. They don't care. You know, they let us be sprayed from the air. They let the poisons in the inoculations, like Health Canada. I mean, it must be another, like, neo-Nazi group like the UN, the World Health Organization is.
Yes.
I mean, the World Health Organization, I mean, now it's come out that AIDS was manufactured in the American military establishment, and it was spread through inoculations in South Africa.
I mean, yeah, I've read about that, yeah.
You know, and now they've got all their new poisons. I mean, they've been designing poisons for people for 60 years, billions and billions of dollars worth, and then they design their poisons, then they come up with their inoculations for when they release their poisons. They got their inoculations. I mean, the whole thing is so, so corrupt and devious.
Yes. I'm sorry to have to do this, but my voice is kind of giving up from this asthma thing I'm struggling with, so you don't mind if we wrap it up right here?
No, that's good. We've spoken a good long time, I hope at some point when you're en route, we'll have you back in a month or so.
Anytime.
And
I'll definitely connect with you guys during April.
Yeah, and as I said, when I meet with you in April, I'd like to sit down and have a bit of time to try to formulate some policies for the Canadian Action Party.
We'll do that for sure.
Yeah, good. Were you aware of the Canadian Action Party?
Oh, yeah, I work with some of their people as well.
Good. I don't know. For me, it's like the situation's so hopeless. At least there's one non-New World psychiatric disordered party. You know, some of us, like, we can work together under that banner, hopefully.
Well, thanks,
Chris. Thank you very much, Kevin, and thank you for your bravery in facing this through the years. And you know, you've gone through a lot to bring out the truth and to really address this kind of terrible chapter in Canada's history.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris, and thanks, Jim.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. I look forward to reading your book and watching your film. And,
yeah.
And I think you've conducted yourself as a good Christian.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, talk to you guys again.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. Huh?
Okay, yeah, so what a story, eh? It just gets worse and worse. As you learn more and more about the things done historically, and
that proverb, knowledge is power, but it's also a bit of a bummer too.
Yeah,
the more
yes.
you learn, the more you're like, oh my god, you know. But that's an important website, and I'll just say it's www.hiddenfromhistory. All one word, .org, and it's a really interesting looking website. I mean, just the way it's laid out, it's
very nicely done.
Beautifully
isn't it?
Done,
yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of important links and documents. So I'll definitely be accessing that. And that's really interesting too. He doesn't even copyright his work.
Yeah,
I mean, he's just putting it out there. So that's not for his personal gain. It's clear he doesn't have huge financial resources and yet he's putting this out there and just saying, like, look, you know, I'm offering you this to, you know, I'm not in this for a buck. I'm in this to spread the word, sort of thing, and expose these interesting lies. I've been reading, switching gears a little bit, I've been reading The Dawkins Delusion, Atheist Fundamentalism and the Denial of the Divine by Alistair McGrath and Joanna Collicutt McGrath.
Wow, that sounds interesting.
Well, Alistair McGrath is a very interesting guy. He wrote a book called, he's very prolific, I think he's written about 20 books. He's a British theologian. He wrote a book called The Twilight of Atheism a few years ago. And he also wrote a book about Richard Dawkins. Work a few years ago, James Memes and something else, I'm not sure exactly the title. His background is interesting. He studied chemistry at Oxford, like Dawkins went to Oxford, and he studied chemistry at Oxford, and then was into biophysics, and he has a PhD from Oxford also, but then he left science and became interested in theology and is now a professor and historian of theology. And his wife is also a scientist, clinical neuropsychologist who also is interested in theology, and they write books together. This is primarily his book, and it's a reply to Dawkins' latest book, The God Delusion, and it's a very, very interesting reply, very informed, and essentially shows that he says that he admired Dawkins' popularization of science and some of his challenges to theology and to Christian theology specifically, and thinks that, you know, that he raises important points, but he says he's so over the top in the God Delusion that it's ludicrous, and it's very, very well argued, very interesting book, and very informative book. But I wish that when people were buying The God Delusion that they'd throw in a copy of this book, because it's such a striking reply to Dawkins' position. So, I'll try to get you a copy of this, Chris, and send it to you. It's just a little book. It's only like about 100 pages, not very long, but because he has a... As I say, he has a more substantial book about Dawkins' earlier work, and he has several different books. I've got another little book there called The Science of God by him, and then there's The Twilight of Atheism. So what he was trying to do was he was trying to react to this popular groundswell of support for Dawkins and for this whole idea that, you know, science has disproved the existence of God, which, as he says, you know, even many scientists, he quotes Stephen Jay Gould, who is probably, you know, the most important, recognizable and important American evolutionary biologist. Dawkins is probably the most important and popular British evolutionary biologist. What he points out is that Gould, in Rock of Ages, Gould writes that, you know, that really science doesn't prove or disprove God, and that he really emphasizes sort of that, you know, religion and science are two distinct domains, and that there's not a
there's not an integration of the knowledge that's derived from each of them, and he's really critical of that approach. And Dawkins apparently couldn't stand Gould, and vice versa. Gould's dead, but Dawkins actually writes in, I don't know if it's in the God delusion, that Gould couldn't possibly have believed what he said in Rock of Ages. And I'm thinking, well, talk about a denial of reality, which is what Dawkins accuses, you know, people who are religious. And you mean he couldn't have possibly believed what he said because he disagrees so diametrically with what you say? Is that what you're saying? I mean, like, it's completely ridiculous, you know, to maintain that. But and I mean, I would disagree with Gould's position too, that science and religion are completely separate domains. But, you know, yeah. It just shows that, as this guy, as McGrath argues, you know, there are all sorts of scientists who have weighed in on this question, and Dawkins is essentially dishonest and deceitful because he puts it out there that in the God delusion that if you believe in science, you couldn't possibly believe in religion or believe in God. But I mean, that's completely ridiculous. I mean, that's just like that's just wrong, you know.
I mean, they're
wrong and it's dishonest, you know, because he knows that's not true.
Well, I mean, I guess it's because they equate religion with what we know as the churches and established religion and fundamentalist belief, but he doesn't consider, like, the substance of religious teaching,
mystical,
like,
or
the content of
ideas. Yeah, I mean, but even in terms of, like, conventional, like, there's all sorts of conventionally religious scientists who are very prominent, you know, who have made major contributions to science, who subscribe to more traditional religious viewpoints. I mean, even in that, like, I mean, how does he explain that? But I mean, that's where I think the position that we take is so radically different from most of the people who participate in this debate, because we're saying, well, you know, the esoteric side of religious teachings teaches something quite different from the conventional churches interpretation.
Yeah, what's understood in the churches.
Yeah,
we see it as religion, I would say, is like a science of the soul.
Yes.
Like, it deals with the nature of the soul and how to attain it and how people fall from the way and you know, how to live a spiritual life.
And addresses issues of consciousness. And,
yeah, it's like the science of the soul.
Reality.
In a way.
Yeah. I mean, and it's such a huge divorce from, you know, from conventional teachings and stereotypical representations of conventional teachings, because even that, like, within even more conventional religious teachings, there are all sorts of different interpretations of scripture and representations of what, you know, a religion teaches. And yet it seems like when these skeptics and atheists, the militant atheists, or who I would say are essentially fundamentalists, when they represent these things, they reduce them to the most fundamental elements, and you know, it's sort of the erection of this straw man that they attack. Well, okay, you know, when they're attacking fundamentalist beliefs, I quite agree with them. You know, they're completely ridiculous,
yeah.
And they're not. Science does contradict many of the things that they teach, but to say that this exhausts religious teachings is ridiculous, and to say that. Well, it doesn't say anything about esoteric or mystical teachings. That's completely, you know, underground and not even in the equation of what they're talking about. And that's, I would say, is really the fundamental error in these critiques, is that they don't seem to recognize that, as you say, that the esoteric tradition can be understood as a science of the soul. It's a science of consciousness and being, and at least a very different understanding of the nature of reality, and includes, I mean, you'll never hear this, includes, like, profound cosmological ideas which are completely coherent and completely rational and are really parallel many of the most advanced notions in modern physics and astrophysics and cosmology. So, you know, how is it that 4,000 years ago people were talking about things that scientists have quote-unquote discovered in the 20th or late 20th century and early 21st century? I mean, you know, it's those things are never really addressed. It's funny, like how these skeptics, you never hear them talk about any of the cosmological ideas that are within these religious teachings. You know, it's just like, oh, well, they're just mythological. Well,
they're not aware of that side of of religion at all. It's more they just see them as belief systems. And
What was that? You have that great quote where in Divine Mysteries where you're saying that you quote Stephen Hawking, and he says that before the 20th century, hardly anybody...
In Blavatsky's time, like in the before the 20th century, people essentially had no idea about the origins of the universe, and it could have existed forever in its present state or have been created. Mainly that they had no idea that it wasn't always in its current shape, kind of.
Yeah.
I get exactly the.
And then you quote Blavatsky, and it's like, you know, it's like, oops.
Yeah.
It's like, and it just shows, or like, you know, like Carl Sagan argues in his books, he says, well, there's nothing really, if you look at religious teachings, there's nothing really that predicts anything that you know, that we can confirm with science. And yet, you know, and you 14th century rabbi talking about the universe arising out of a point source of light, you know, and I mean precisely what 20th century physics has come to conclude, you know.
The
singularity condition that, and this is in Kabbalistic teachings.
And all their ideas about, like, the nature of the root principles of creation and how space is the void and the plenum.
Yeah.
You find that in the Secret Doctrine. You find that in Kabbalistic teachings.
Yeah.
And in Hinduism. You find that in different religious cosmologies.
Yeah. And
that's all confirmed by modern science.
And what's most interesting, and I think this is where your work is really unique and really important in drawing this attention to this, is that if you look at the heart doctrine throughout the esoteric and mystical traditions, and the notion of the divine spark or this point source, this sort of singularity within the human heart, which is rooted into the higher dimensions of the heart and into the higher dimensions of reality, is that the processes and the laws operative are being described in the descriptions of the heart doctrine are really quite parallel those that apply to physical cosmology. It's like the singularity point, which exists within human beings, also exists within the cosmos.
And how we really are
a microcosm of the macrocosm.
Yeah, and how we too come out of the nothingness.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. I love that quote from a Sufi sage who says, "Not since God brought men out of nothingness have we ceased to be travelers." And you find that idea in so many of the mystical traditions, like the primordial nothingness, kind of, which isn't simply a nothingness, but is the plenum. But I see the most critical issue in regards to the debate between science and religion is the nature of human consciousness.
Yes.
Is consciousness a product of material processes in the brain, or is it connected to the spiritual soul and connected to the heart? So there, I think you can lay scientific ideas and religious ideas side by side and see that the religious ideas provide a scientific framework of ideas to understand the issues of consciousness in a completely different way than what we've been told for the last century.
And what I really see more and more, I understand that this is my own, I really strongly believe this now, is how fundamentally mistaken people are in believing that consciousness is really only a property that arises or emerges out of the neurochemical processes in the human brain. Because when you assume that, you're stuck. Because the rest of it's really saying, it's funny, like scientists always say that all religious people want to elevate man to some sort of special status, and they want to they can't withstand the blows to the egocentric nature of religious teachings, in the sense that people think that human beings and the earth is some sort of special place. But really, if you think about it, the current understanding of consciousness, where consciousness really only emerges out of the electrochemical and biological processes in the human brain, that's saying that human beings are special. That's elevating human beings to this peculiar platform and saying nowhere else in the cosmos is there any intelligence like this. Does consciousness exist? I mean, to me, like, that's completely absurd. Like, that's a denial of reality, because really, the more compelling and the more coherent perspective is to suggest that consciousness is some sort of fundamental attribute of existence, that it's irreducible and that it's there. It just is. And therefore, there's consciousness throughout the universe, not just in the operations of those little chemical processes in the human brain. And I would say that when you turn that perspective on its head, and especially when you put it in terms of the heart doctrine, then you can compare mystical and esoteric teachings to modern scientific ideas. And in terms of understanding all sorts of anomalous and enigmatic phenomena associated with consciousness, I think that the heart doctrine provides a much more compelling and attractive model of consciousness than the head doctrine.
Yeah, that's what I see. It's like all these scientists, they don't consider all the evidences for human beings having paranormal or psychical or spiritual experiences. Like, there's a huge volume of evidences. Even many people who have investigated paranormal phenomena, like scientifically, there's a huge body of literature suggesting that human beings can, for instance, experience consciousness apart from the body, be conscious when they're having a near-death experience and they're outside of their body and witnessing events and in other places, and examples of the ESP and ghosts and reincarnation. There's evidence for all these phenomena. And people who think they're like real scientists, they just dismiss all these things as though all this body of evidence doesn't exist. And then they think that's being scientific. It's not being scientific. It's just being small-minded. And they're stuck in this kind of materialist paradigm, which doesn't even hold true in modern physics.
Yeah.
Because modern physics can't be said to be materialistic anymore.
Yeah.
It's not. I mean, you reduce quanta to, you know, mathematical possibilities for the manifestation of particles. You know, solidarity of the world disappeared as the scientists probed nature more deeply, and things became more and more mysterious rather than less mysterious.
Well, that's what always strikes me in these guys, and I write about this in The Problem of God's Contracting Universe. It's like Carl Sagan, you know, he's this real hard-headed materialist and writes a book about the Dragons of Eden about human intelligence, and never even uses the word consciousness or mind to discuss it. And he talks about, you know, he'll not entertain the idea that the mind is in, that there's some separate mind from the physical processes of the brain, that really the mind is just another word for the brain's operations.
And he says there's not one iota
of evidence for that. And, you know, I mean, it's a pretty concerted act of intellectual myopia to make that statement, because that's just not true. I mean, that's so overwhelmingly contradicted by evidence that it's ridiculous to even say that. I mean, it's just like, you know, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for this book, you know, The Dragons of Eden. But like, Sagan is like, you know, I realize that, you know, he's in his writings, he covers a lot of different areas of science. Very intelligent guy in terms of, like, and widely read and interested in a lot of different issues. And you can learn a lot about a lot of different things scientifically from reading his books. One thing I realized one day, though, was there's really, in his books, it's really interesting, because he talks about Einstein at one point as being his scientific hero. But it's really interesting that in his book, there's never really any discussion of the philosophical implications of 20th century physics. And yet 20th century physics really sounds the death knell to materialism as Carl Sagan subscribes to it. You know, it's just not a tenable philosophical or scientific position, because really 20th century physics shows that you have to deal with information and consciousness, which is beyond the physical. Like Eddington said that 20th century physics had revealed the world to be a shadow world of appearances, and he makes like really deliberate allusions to Plato's cave, and, you know, the idea that what we see is a projection of something which is beyond the material and beyond the physical. And Eddington actually says this opens the door to mysticism. He wasn't saying that science was proving mysticism, but what he was saying was that the mystics may have access to sources of information and levels of understanding that are clearly beyond the limits of science. You know, and I mean, all sorts of different 20th century celebrated physicists were in that camp, in the sense that they all kind of came to the view that, you know, we can only go so far, and clearly there's something else. Like Heisenberg was really informed and understood Eastern philosophical traditions, and said, actually told Friedhof Capra that he had actually drawn on that in his work in terms of formulating the uncertainty principle and some of his work. And Niels Bohr was very influenced by such ideas. And I mean, again, Schrodinger was really attracted to, I mean, it, you know, you can go through all of these guys. James Jean said, you know, that the more we study the universe, the more it resembles a great thought rather than a great machine, you know, which was the reference to the Newtonian worldview of the world of consisting of great clockworks. And yeah,
it's interesting, but they don't then see, though, also that in religious teachings, the manifested world is regarded as an outpouring or a manifestation of divine thought, that
they're
called the builders or the masons that kind of construe reality. So what's produced is like the product of information and intelligence.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, I mean, that's really what, if you look at these things carefully and you look at them with an open mind, I think that's what you realize, is that, hey, there's actually a very you know, sophisticated, elegant, coherent explanation as to what lies beyond the material, and it's not irrational, it's not insubstantial, and it's not something that can't be tested or known, at least known empirically, and yet, like you say, people like Sagan, it just like there's no discussion of any of this, and yet they're very confident in saying, well, the religions don't really teach anything that, you know, that is testable scientifically or predicts anything scientifically, which is completely ludicrous.
Yeah, that's why this issue of consciousness is just so important.
It's
like critical to the soul. I mean, the science religion debate.
Yeah,
does a human being have a soul?
It's completely unrecognized. It's like the third element, that in terms of the law of three, it's like the neutralizing element. You have the usual sort of what Gurdjieff calls formatory conceptualization of things, which is the lowest level of the mind, and which always sees things in twos. Gurdjieff says that's, he characterizes that as the terms of formatory thinking. So there's this and there's that. There's always, everything's in terms of opposites. But he says human beings are third force blind because they don't recognize that in all twos there's always a third element, which is often hidden, or which is part of the medium in which something exists, but which is really, you have to recognize the third element in order to understand something comprehensively. And I would say that the debate between science and religion is really an uninformed debate, as long as you don't understand the critical importance of recognizing that consciousness is the key to understanding. It's the key to understanding what religion and science are really saying, and integrating them on a completely different level.
Yeah. And you see then how the issues of consciousness are like the number one unresolved mystery in modern science and philosophy, and like no one can answer that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which is exactly what one would expect from a mystical perspective, because they have the completely wrong idea about what consciousness is.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I remember reading like almost 30 years ago that essay by Swami Prabhupada.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying, he was the person who brought Krishna consciousness to America. And I remember him saying, he says, you know, you have all your departments of knowledge, but you ignore the most important department, which is like the department of God consciousness.
Yeah.
Like there's a science of the soul, a science of consciousness, and you have all these departments, but no one looks at the most critical issues. And that's what modern psychology became. No one looks at, you know, the existence of the human spirit and soul, and what is consciousness.
you know.
Yeah, and he's talking with the member when he talks with Gregory Benford, the physicist, and they're sitting on the grass, and he says, you want to study the grass, you know, and you want to be able to understand its constituent parts and break it down into its chemical, a chemical analysis of what grass is and a physical analysis and everything, but you don't want to know, you know, that what it is that where the grass fits in relation to God, you know, and that all of this is being created by God, you know, and you don't want to look beyond the material to see what actually, you know, informs it and is the intelligence behind the material.
Yeah.
Which is...
It's interesting also how you see when they have surveys and they ask groups of people, you know, how many people believe in God or something beyond the grave or something
yeah.
beyond existence. And it's like usually at least 75 to 80% of people believe in something, even though that may be very ill-defined,
mm-hmm.
you know. But generally, the masses of people believe there's something more. And I would say that's intuitive spiritual knowledge because there is something more. So I would say people have that intuitive knowledge in their heart that they feel there's something more. This isn't all there is to it.
Yeah,
and it's no matter how you know, we've had the kind of materialist philosophy in education for the past century, and yet the populace still believes in their hearts that there's something more to it.
Yeah, and
it's very curious.
I think part of it, too, I mean, I think that's right, and I think part of it, too, is that I think people have anomalous experiences that don't fit in readily into... you know, or conventional explanations, and that's why I was thinking. I was talking to somebody earlier today about, you know, the near-death phenomena is really the near-death experience when people, you know, in the last 30 years or so, we've had this really incredible development in resuscitation technology and cardiovascular medicine where people can be pronounced clinically dead and yet can be revived and can survive, you know, and so that's really, it's really interesting. And when you consider that in terms of the whole mystical and esoteric tradition, the experiences that people report are so clearly congruent with those of religious and mystical experiences where people encounter beings of light, you know, and have these transformative experiences where they sense the essential all rightness of the universe, and they realize that there's something beyond the material, and they have an experience of feeling gratitude for being alive, and they encounter spiritual dimensions and spiritual figures. And I mean, it goes on, and really, this is really all very congruent with the mystical tradition and what people report having mystical experiences. I mean, broadly speaking, because there's mystical experiences, all sorts of different levels and different types of experiences.
I mean, there's kind of hell worlds and
worlds, because some people have the negative too. Like, more commonly with the near-death experience, that's what people report. You know, everybody knows about going down the tunnel of light, and it's become sort of a cultural piece of knowledge that people sort of joke about too, and you know, I mean, you can see it in The Simpsons and, you know, like cartoons and stuff. But it's really interesting. I think Raymond Moody was the first person who wrote about it. He wrote Life After Life, and then there's been a whole bunch of people who've taken up Kenneth Ring and Sabum and a variety of people. But it's interesting how I think both Ring and Sabum's a medical doctor, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
Kenneth Ring is a psychologist.
Yeah.
And I think Kenneth Ring, I know Sabum for sure, started as a skeptic and investigated to sort of disprove the phenomena, you know, to show that it was some sort of artifact of the brain chemistry, that people were anoxic or whatever. And it's really interesting because when you really look at that literature, and I'm by no means an expert in this, but I've read enough of it that I think I can state fairly confidently that when you really look at it, that all of the material explanations really don't, you know, hold water. I mean, what it really does is that it really shows that the materialist explanation of consciousness is severely lacking, you know. And then, as I say, if you compare it to the mystical and esoteric tradition and the explanations of consciousness, which model of consciousness subsumes these anomalous experiences? I mean, they're not anomalous within the mystical and esoteric tradition, but they certainly don't fit any kind of parameter that the materialist explanation would provide. There's no way that this can happen.
No, that's why kind of a mystical science perspective is more advanced, I would say.
That's
because you
argue.
Can incorporate the mainstream ideas of science and physics, but then you don't deny all the evidences of multidimensional existence. You know, I mean, I think the evidence is overwhelming for it. But often it comes also if you've had your own experiences, which also convince you of the existence of these states and experiences.
Yeah.
And
did you get that email I sent you about the third man factor?
Yeah, that were the angels, kind of like.
Yeah. This guy has Jonathan Geiger, I believe is his name, has written this book, and he has written several books about exploration. This is the phenomena where people under extreme circumstances and stress have experienced the presence of some sort of presence which has dialogues with them and guides them and informs them about things. Ernest Shackelford, the explorer who studied explored the Antarctic, had this experience, and Charles Lindbergh, when he was flying across the Atlantic in the Spirit of St. Louis, actually had spiritual presences guiding him and navigating him, because he was sleep deprived, you know,
which would make him more open and vulnerable, kind of to.
Yeah, and he's collected about 100 of these experiences and put them in this book at the Third Man Factor, and I'm really looking forward to reading it. But
I heard them on Coast to Coast last week.
Oh, yeah. Did people call in with their experiences?
Because
that's what always kills me is when you hear people provide their accounts of their experiences.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Like a woman phoned into CBC because they had a discussion on the current of CBC radio, and she was talking about how she was driving in the mountains, and she was doing the speed limit, and all of a sudden she heard her father's voice say, "Slow down," and to her with her name, and it was definitely her father's voice. He's dead, and she went around this corner. She slowed down. She went around this corner, and there'd been like it was a rock slide. And
wow.
If she'd have been speeding along, she would have been buried under the rocks. Eh?
Yeah, just a little incident like that. Yeah.
But the best one, the one that really was incredible, was that this woman phoned in with talking about her father's experience during the Second World War. He was in India. Now, this is really out there, but he was in India, and he was in circumstances where it was very, very hot, and he was very, very tired, and all of a sudden, he was transported, and he was in Europe, on a battlefield in Europe, and he saw his best friend lying on the ground, wounded, and the medics were coming and picking up bodies and wounded and carrying them back to the aid station, but they didn't see him, and they missed him, and they all disappeared. So he picked up his friend, put him on his shoulder, and carried him back to the aid station.
Wow.
Now, years later, you know, he was talking to his friend. He saw his friend at some sort of reunion or something, and his friend said, "You know, I never said this to you, but this is really strange, but, you know, I have the feeling that somehow you rescued me when I was lying wounded on the battlefield."
Wow.
And he said, "Now, I know you weren't there, but I felt it was you that carried me back to the aid station." And her father had never spoken to him about this experience. Now, that's impossible. You know, let's just get this straight. That's just not possible, right? But, I mean, that is so interesting. Eh? Because if that happened, we've got big problems in terms of explaining things, you know, because that can't happen, right? But what an incredible experience, eh? I mean,
that makes conceivable, like, the claims of people like Babaji and Yogananda that masters can actually dematerialize their bodies.
Well, actually, Yogananda, and I think an autobiography of Yogi, I think it was the Second World War, but it might have been the First World War, where he experiences when in deep meditation, all of a sudden being on the battlefield and seeing all soldiers and everything. I'd have to go back and read the story again, but I remember that he talks about that he had this experience of being transported you know, thousands of miles away and experiencing this. But to actually physically intervene, I mean, it's one thing for somebody to be aware. See, like that part, I kind of can accept that, but to actually pick somebody up and carry them to the aid station and for the guy to later to say, you know, hey, you know, and they'd never talked about it. I mean, that's, that's a really, but this whole experience of the third man factor, I'd be very interested to, you know, see what kind of reactions people have to this, because I've had this experience where I've had somebody talk to me, you know, who wasn't there, allegedly, you know, and gave me some very good advice, I might add, too.
You find so many incidents like that, especially around people's deaths originally.
Right.
Like, and it makes sense then, like, people, you know, someone appears as a ghost to someone that evening, or they feel that they're there in the room, or they hear their breathing, and different things like that, or, you know, the father's clock stops, like, so many kind of paranormal phenomena. I think that, especially when people first pass over, they're often around us quite a bit, and likely come into our aura, or vicinity, at times of threat and fear and things like that, or when if we call out to someone, or I know we're getting down. We got just a few minutes left. I would like to again thank Kevin Annette. And what was Kevin's website? Jim, give it once more.
www.hiddenfromhistory.org.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, and
that was very interesting. Another ugly chapter, terrible chapter in Canadian history.
Yeah,
you just wonder, like, why don't we ever see justice on Earth? Eh? It's like there's just no justice in anything. You know, what's happening in the world? You know, the people of Gaza are like those poor people. You know, it's just unbelievable the things being done.
There's a lot of crime to be answered for. If there's some sort of great reckoning in, you know, some other world, there's a lot.